is Rob Berger. How is everyone tonight? Checking out the chat. As always, if you can give me a thumbs up that things are working, I would be grateful. I see Noreen is already here and keeping people in line. Thank you. I've taken a look at a lot of the comments pre-show, not all of them. Douglas says, hello from Western Massachusetts, and thanks for your wealth of info. You're welcome. Western Massachusetts. Well, I lived in Boston. That's not Western Massachusetts. Oh, Dave gave me the thumbs up. All right. Thank you. So we're going to start. My monologue, as I guess I call it now, is going to be pretty short, but I've gotten a lot. It's surprising to me how many emails I've received. And the question has all been similar. It's this. It's a, hey, Rob, we got this debt ceiling thing hanging over us. Should we avoid treasury bills? If we're looking at short-term investing, you know, or saving, and we're going to need this money, you know, if they don't reach an agreement and the U.S. government defaults, at least for a time, presumably they're not going to, like, you know, default forever. But could there be some disruption in the return of our money? Remember the way a T-bill works, those are all short. The T-bills are, they mature in under a year. The longest one's what, 52 weeks. And you don't get any interest payments along the way. You just get more than you invested at the end. And that difference, you know, whatever it is, you back it out. You can figure out your yield, but that's your interest. So you get it all at the end when the T-bill matures. Could be just a few weeks. Depends on, of course, whether you're buying one that's newly issued or you're buying one in the secondary market. But in any event, should we avoid T-bills and instead, you know, maybe FDIC insured banks are safer? Well, here's my two cents. First of all, I have both. So, and they serve different purposes. I mean, most of my bank accounts right now are checking accounts. I don't really have, now I have some in savings. So I do have some in an FDIC insured savings account. I had some CDs with Save Better. I've pulled those out now because we're going to be spending the money. I used a no penalty, one of their no penalty options, which, by the way, I put this in the newsletter. The top no penalty there was 4.4, but then Ponce Bank, not Ponce, Ponce, came out with a four-month no penalty CD at 4.41%. The 4.4, how long? It's for like, let's see, I'll look it up here. It's for like 13, 14 months? 14 months, right here it is. I would actually go with the 14-month no penalty for 440 over the four-month, you know, of course, it's only one basis point. But I'd prefer to have to be able to lock it in for 14 months. If rates go up and I want to get out of it, I can. I think with Save Better, you got to stay in it for 30 days now. But I could get out of it, you know, with after 30 days if rates go up. But if rates go down, I'd rather lock in 440 for 14 months than 441 for four. But it's technically the highest rate right now. In any event, a couple of things. So FDIC insurance does not rely on, I was going to say the chuckleheads in Washington. That wouldn't be nice. It doesn't rely on Congress's, you know, appropriating money, right? It doesn't rely on taxpayers. That's not where the FDIC insurance fund comes from. It comes from member banks. They have to pay a fee. So if you want to be FDIC insured, you got to send a truckload of money to the FDIC to pay the fees. It's all based on, I don't know what it's based on, but I'm pretty confident, among other things, size of the bank, right? And so getting paid, so first of all, before you'd have to even worry about this, your bank would have to go under, right? But then you wouldn't have to wait on Congress to raise the debt ceiling for FDIC insurance to kick in. So I suppose in that sense, a bank account is less risky, maybe, kind of. My only hesitation is, one, it's hard for me to believe that we're really going to default on our debt. Now, some of you are rolling your eyes. It's like, Rob, have you not been paying attention? I don't know why in the world you think it's not possible, or not, I guess anything's possible. I get it. And I think each time we go through this, it seems to get a little worse, partly because our debt's getting worse and worse and worse. We're at what, $31 trillion, and that doesn't even count everything. But I still find it hard to believe Congress is going to let us default on our debt. But if they did, it's possible where you would be delayed in getting your money back. That's possible. And so I suppose in that sense, if I were concerned enough about that possibility, I would probably just do a bank account. I mentioned CDs, but let's see here. What's the top savings account? It's pretty close. I got some. Look at this. This is my site, by the way. I got some image issues here I'm working on. I don't know what the problem is, but I got folks working on it. Anyway, 435 is what I'm seeing. This is my savings direct. These are all just ordered by, the rate. I tend to include only banks that are available nationwide. So you might find a better deal at sort of your local credit union or a bank that only operates in your, maybe one or two states or whatever. I think the T-bill is around 4.8, depending on the exact duration. So, you'd lose a little there. But again, you could go to, if we go to CDs, we looked at the no penalty. The highest rate I've seen is 5%. That's Navy Federal. Sally Mae's got it as well. Now that you got to lock that in for 27 months. So anyway, it's a trade-off. Like I said, I'm not overly worried about it. I have money in T-bills right now. And money that I'll need because it's money that we're going to use to do some work on the house. So, the other thing too is we will have some warnings, right? I mean, they're using what, extraordinary measures? That's what the Treasury calls it. But we'll know when the deadline's coming. So you could always sell your T-bills. I suppose one could say, well, wait a minute. What if everyone's selling their T-bills and the price tanks and I don't, get full value? I guess anything's possible. I just find that unlikely. That's my take. Now, having said all that, I'm going to do a poll. How likely is the U.S. to default on its debt? And I mean, during this particular crisis, I'll say very likely. Likely, not very likely. I'm starting to not like the word likely. And then never. Never is the wrong way. Not a chance. That's better. Oh yeah. And my capitalization is all messed up. I gotta get some capitalization consistency going. I don't know if there's a typo, but there's the poll. All right, so I have a few questions that came in that I saw before the show. I don't know if I'll be able to get to all of them. I'm going to do a couple. Here was from Rad. He says, how does a windfall later in retirement affect the 4% rule? Should you recalculate the starting withdrawal amount? That's a great question. Here's how I would think through it. The first thing I'd want to kind of make sure I had an understanding of is how guaranteed is this windfall? And how certain am I of the timing? Because that's going to matter. Like if you're thinking inheritance, you're going to inherit something from someone, but you don't know when they're going to die, that matters. When it's going to come in matters a lot. But let's just assume, I don't know, that you're going to get some chunk of money at a point in retirement. I would probably use a tool. New retirement can do this. As I've been promising for weeks now, I am working on Maxify, and I think it can do it. But I'll show you the free one that we talk about a lot, just to give you an idea, is FiCalc, right? And you could model a little bit of it here. So we're just using the Bill Bengen constant dollar approach. But down here, let's see how much detail. We can add additional income, but can we get specific? Name, windfall. Amount. I don't know, Rad. What do you think? $1 million. No, million. I'm going to put it in. We're starting with $1 million portfolio. So I'll just say 300,000. We're not going to adjust it for inflation. Income start. So here you can put in, I don't know, year 10. It doesn't repeat and 1 year. So it's just a one-time thing. You can add that. And of course, it gives you a success rate of 100%. But remember, we haven't changed our initial withdrawal rate, which was your question, right? If we come down here and look at a specific year, let's see what this does to the chart. Yeah, so because we're doing constant dollar, our spending never changes on an after inflation basis. But somewhere in here, probably, let's see, it was year 10, right? Somewhere in here it jumped up. But what we could start to do, to your point, Rad, is start to increase our initial withdrawal and see if, you know, let's do 5%. So we still got a 92.62% success rate, which isn't bad for a 5% withdrawal. And then you can look, of course, whenever you run this, this is true no matter what tool you use, assuming it's using U.S. data, and you start to see years where things get ugly. The late 60s, and here even the early 60s, are the big issue because of inflation in the 70s and early 80s. But you could play with this and get some rough idea. This doesn't include global stocks, I don't think. And you'd probably be able to model it in much more detail with something like New Retirement. There's a link to New Retirement below the video, I think. They are an advertiser. I haven't actually thought about this in terms of Maxify. Maxify is not an advertiser, by the way. But you might be able to do it with Maxify. I'm pretty sure you can. Well, actually, let's just look, because I've got all the data. I've got all my test data in Maxify ready to go to do that. I actually did the video once and wasn't happy with it. So I deleted it. I'm going to redo it. And then my next video, by the way, is to actually compare Maxify and New Retirement side by side. I'm really excited about that. I know. I need to get a life. So here's Maxify. This is all dummy data. But it's data, by the way, that I'm going to start using consistently across all of these tools so we can compare apples to apples. Once you know how to navigate Maxify, it's fine, but it does take a little getting used to. But if we go to financial assets, and I've got John and Jane, but I think, I don't know. Maybe we can't model that in that kind of thing. You've got to be able to. Let's go to Jane, current earnings. I'll have to look at that. Maybe you can't model that in Maxify. Anyway, I'll give that some thought. You definitely can in New Retirement. One of the things I wanted to mention, so Maxify takes, they give you sort of default settings. Of course, you can change everything, but one of them is that you're going to live to be 100. Congratulations. Good for you. And so is your spouse, if you're married or significant other. Your returns aren't going to be so good, like 3.5% or 3.75%, something like that. And the idea is, let's be super conservative. That's sort of the thinking behind it. And I get it. There is, though, a problem with that, because everything in all these kind of analysis is interconnected. So think about this. You put in there you're going to live to be 100. And then you ask the program, all right, when should I take Social Security? Well, you should wait till you're 70 in most cases, because you're going to live to be 100. Should I annuitize part of my portfolio? You bet. Of course you should. You're going to live to be 100. and by the way, your earnings aren't that great if you invested only 3.75%. So you got to be a little careful with that. And I've been playing with different assumptions, and you can actually do that. You can see I've got assumptions already built in. Base profile, I've got I call it the die. I don't know how you probably can't read that very well. The die early. That's what I've called this profile. And then I've got one for higher returns, because it affects all those other things. Anyway, all right, enough of that. I don't even know what's happening anymore on this show. Joshua had a number of questions, but basically his question was about SCHD. We've talked about that Schwab dividend fund. It's really a large cap value. I like it a lot. I think it's a reasonable choice. He put a lot of information into his different allocations across different accounts, which kind of hard for me to track. But I mean, I think if you lean towards value, I think I like it enough to invest in it. Let's see. So this comes from Ho She Ya. I'm sorry. I'm sure I've butchered that name. Hello from New Jersey. You know, I'll be in New Jersey soon. You know, I'm thinking I'm going to race into a gas station and try to pump my own gas and see what happens. It's probably like a felony. Anyway, I have an 80-20 three-fund portfolio. It looks like they're all Fidelity funds. I can't show you this on the screen, by the way, the question, I don't think, anyway. Anyway, would there be any value in adding BRKB, Berkshire Hathaway, to the mix? And would that just be overlapping? Well, it definitely wouldn't be overlapping. I mean, your U.S. stock fund is going to have Berkshire in it. But what it's going to do is tilt your portfolio towards financials, towards insurance, maybe towards energy. I started to say away from technology, but their stake in Apple is so large. It's funny, from, you know, we categorize investments into these sectors, right? And Apple, maybe it's consumer goods. I don't know how do they, I don't really, it's funny. I don't really think of Apple as a technology company, at least not in the same way as I do, say, a Google. And that's just, that's just me. How does, I'm trying to think, I've never really looked at the, if Morningstar categorizes each company, they must. Probably tech, maybe it's consumer, I don't know. Anyway, you're going to tilt your portfolio into some of those sectors. And you're also going to, of course, it's going to give you single company risk. So it, you know, it may be hard to imagine. Yeah, consumer electronics. Yeah, that makes sense. It's like, what would Google be? Took up Google. Goog. Alphabet. Pardon me. Internet content and information. Oh, it's communication services. Well, that's interesting. Let me go back. No, it is technology. I was looking at industry. So they call it technology. I get why they do that. To me, it's different than a lot of other technology companies. In any event, it's really not part of your question. You know, you are going to have some single stock exposure. You know, what if there's fraud someday at Berkshire? You know, you know, there are big issues. You're going to expose your portfolio to the kinds of things that can happen to a single company, or maybe it's just, you know, Warren Buffett moves on, you know, other folks take over, and it just slowly doesn't do as well, or it doesn't do as well just because it's so large, you know, it sort of slowly slides and doesn't quite do as well as the S&P 500. I mean, I own it. I'm perfectly content owning it. That being said, it's a pretty small portion of our portfolio, a few percent, I guess. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's relatively small. Okay. So James says, I'm 31. I want to buy a home in the next 4 to 8 years. Do you see the housing market going down anytime soon? I you know, I know that particularly with interest rates rising, mortgage rates rising, I mean, it looks like it's been going down now or on the verge of going down. Part of it depends on where you live. But I'll tell you, I don't pretend to be able to predict that. And I've bought homes in both good times and bad. And at the end of the day, it's worked out just fine. And whenever you do buy, we tend to anchor our view of it to the recent past. So if, let's say, the home values in your area have gone down 5%, that seems to feel, or 10%, it feels like a good time to buy. Yeah, maybe it is, maybe it's not, right? And, you know, if housing's gone up 10%, well, maybe this isn't the best time. And there certainly are, of course, buyer and seller markets. We've all, if you've bought a home, you've experienced that. When we bought the home we lived in, you know, it was basically a contingency-free contract. And we sold ours the same way. We did not pay over list for this home, but we did pay the asking price. We sold our home, at least that's my memory. We sold our home for more than what we had it listed for, you know, and that was a seller's market. But I really can't tell you that I've got my finger on the pulse of the real estate market. I just don't. G Branding says, I've been reading The Tao of Charlie Munger. The book emphasizes patience and a lot of talk that to me sounds like market timing. Is Munger a market timer? And then buy and hold. He's definitely not a market timer. And I'll tell you the difference. By the way, I've been reading this book. Oh, it's a beast. It's a lot of fun. A lot of drawings, a lot of pictures. So Munger is a value investor. So he's looking at the value. So when he buys something, he thinks it's undervalued or at least fairly valued. I don't think he's thinking to himself, I'm going to buy this because in the next 6 months, I think the price is going to go up, or in the next year. That's a market timer. Buying it because they think there's going to be some price movement in their favor in the relative short term. I don't think that's how Charlie Munger thinks at all. No. Okay. All right. One last question, and then I'll turn to the questions that I can show you on the screen. This is from Dave. What are the skills that go into making a good chess player, and which, if any, are useful in navigating financial freedom successfully? Well, certainly planning, right? Because you have to think as much as you can, a number of moves, you know, into the future. You might see a move that looks great, but then you have to say, what are the consequences? It looks like I can take my opponent's queen with my pawn. Boy, that seems like a pretty good deal. But you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, what are the consequences of doing that? And I think financial freedom requires that. Any sort of just smart, you know, being smart with your money, you have to think sort of, I don't think you need to think 37 moves ahead, by the way. I don't think this is complicated. Well, chess is. Financial freedom is not. But I think you have to think a couple of moves ahead. You also have to be willing. Here's, a good parallel. In chess, you have to be willing to consider what at first seems like a really bad move. So, you know, you think, I can put the other side in check with my queen, but that's a dumb move. They'll take my queen with their bishop. So you stop thinking, right? Just like you think, well, it would be great to live in walking distance to work, and I could get rid of my car maybe, or we could go from two cars to one. But I can't do that because I work over here and there's nowhere to live nearby. I have to drive. And so you stop. You never ask the what if questions. This is actually a big section of my book, Retire Before Mom and Dad. In chess, you have to say, what if? Okay, I move my queen, check, he takes it with the bishop. All right, what if that happens? Now what? Now, a lot of times what you'll find is, yeah, that's a bad move. I'm going to lose my queen. Yeah, I can't do that. But you'd be surprised how many times you're like, wait a minute. He can't take my queen with his bishop, because if he does, I move my rook and put him in checkmate. And I think a lot of the financial freedom that we were able to attain was similar thinking, where we might initially, like with car, we have a second car now, but for a long time we only had one. And both my wife and I, our initial reaction was like, I can't do that. It'll take my queen. Right? We can't do that. We can't live on one car. And we were both pleasantly surprised. We did it anyway, because I figured, what's the worst case happens? I'll go buy another car. So we sold. It was actually on a lease, which I don't ever lease cars, but this is for a business. But in any event, we sent it back, didn't have a car, worked out great. The only reason we got another one was because of our granddaughter. So I think there's a big overlap, because I think financial freedom requires the willingness to think beyond your initial objections to things. Yeah, that's what I can think of. All right. What do we got? So Josh wants to know, what is the best way to rebalance a taxable account that has individual factor funds to avoid taxes? Use dollar cost averaging to increase funds that are down. So a couple of thoughts. Yes, if you have additional contributions, you can make them into the different funds. It wouldn't have to be just if you're factor funds. You could have a very basic, simple portfolio and kind of do the same thing. As you make new contributions, put them into the funds that need some additional assets to bring you closer to your plan. You could also not reinvest dividends automatically, right? You're going to get taxed on them anyway, but take them to a cash account and then put them into the funds that need more assets. And then the third thing I would mention is you can rebalance a taxable account in your retirement accounts. What I mean by that is, if you know you can make changes in your retirement account that help bring your overall portfolio, both your retirement and your taxable, into line with your plan. Now, that takes some planning and setting up your asset location to begin with, but that's what I've done. So, like, there are a few exceptions where I probably couldn't do it that way. Like, if I needed to reduce small cap, I couldn't do that without paying some taxes. So I probably just wouldn't reduce it, at least to a point. But most of my asset classes, and I don't have that many, I can add to or subtract from in my retirement account and avoid the taxes. So if you have that luxury, that's another option. Of course, there could be some years, depending on your financial situation, where you could actually take some gains and not pay taxes, but that may not apply to you. Depends on your financial situation. Oh, we got someone from Manassas. That's my neck of the woods. Hey, Kenneth. Manassas. It's a fun name to say. I think they had a battle there or two. So Kat says, thoughts on safe withdrawal. Should I think about taking a percentage out of my investments or think in terms of my net worth? Well, it depends what your net worth is comprises, but I tend to think of it in terms of investments. I mean, for most people, you've got your investments and then maybe you have your house. I don't include in my net worth personal property. I don't include my cars, which eventually, you know, depreciate to nothing. I don't include the furniture in the house. I don't even include my spiffy Untuckit shirts, which would be a substantial addition to our net worth. I don't include them. So I think of it just in terms of our, you know, invested assets. Now, I do, not from a calculation perspective, but I do, and I should reiterate, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm just a guy with a YouTube channel. So keep that in mind. I do, though, view our house as sort of our ace up the sleeve, you know, that I can pull out if we were in a bad situation, because we can downsize, we can move to a less expensive area of the country. I suppose at some point we could consider a reverse mortgage, although I kind of find it hard to imagine I would ever do that, but I think that they can serve a purpose. So it's not, I don't totally disregard our home, but I don't add its value. I don't add the value of my business to thinking through our safe withdrawal rate. That's my approach. It's funny. I didn't see this when I commented on my shirt, but Troy says, hey, Rob, where do you get your shirts? Love them. Hey, see, they're all Untuckit. You can't really, can you see? That's the Untuckit symbol, the triangle. I don't know. I should like call them up and ask if I can, they should pay me at least with some free shirts. I get nothing from them. Kearney says, can you give some strategies or websites to visit for 3 to 5 year savings for my college daughter? College is fully covered. I think you may have emailed me and or left a comment. This question seems familiar. So what I understand is you want to save some money for 3 to 5 years. And then I don't know, you're going to give it to your daughter or she's going to spend it on, it's not college because that's fully covered. Anyway, that's how I'm going to interpret it. 3 to 5 years is tough because, you know, if you put it in the stock market, you know, being down 5 years in a row, I don't think that's ever happened. If we think S&P 500, I think 4 years is the longest, right? I think that's right. But of course, that doesn't mean we couldn't have 5 years in a row, right? Also, just because you don't have 5 years in a row of a down market doesn't mean it gets back to where it started, right? It could have 3 bad years and then 2 positive years, but you still aren't back to where you started. So you could definitely lose money over a 5 year period. In fact, maybe we can look at this. Let's check this out. I think I can do this in Portfolio Visualizer, right? So we'll just do an asset allocation portfolio. We'll just use US stock market, 100%. What I'm thinking here is, rolling returns. 5 year. So the worst 5 year period, according to Portfolio Visualizer, you were down 6%. And you can even go out 10 years and can be down, right? Now, that, again, that doesn't mean every year was a loss, right? It's just at the end of that period, you had up, you had obviously bad years. Maybe you had a good year or two, but you ended up negative. Now, if for 15 years, you know, you're positive every 15 years. So can you guys see that? Yeah, I realize I got the comment on the screen. So, you know, with the way right now, I'd probably just keep it in relatively short-term bonds. If I know that it needed to be spent 3 to 5 years from now, you know, you could maybe argue some sort of balanced fund or a little bit of stocks. I don't know what percent. I mean, you know, I suppose you could even do, let's look at this. We can model this. I mean, of course, this is just looking at history. So we don't know. Doesn't mean this is what's going to happen, right? We'll use 10-year treasuries. Doesn't really matter. I just want something safe. An intermediate term. Well, 10 years kind of longish, but it's good. And we look at the rolling returns on this. I got to believe 5 years is positive. Yeah, but barely. 80 bips is the low for a 5 year period. But you said 3 to 5. So even with a 50-50 portfolio, in theory, just again, based on history, you could be in negative 3.5%. Of course, you may say, well, I can live with that because there's upside, right? I could be 25% to the good or almost 10% to the good with this kind of portfolio. So you're willing to take the risk, but that's kind of how I think through it. But I generally, if I know I'm going to need money in 3 to 5 years, I'm either thinking, okay, will I have the income and get it from that? If not, I'm going to be in some sort of fixed income investment. That's how I would do it. All right. It's funny to see the comments that come in later. I don't know why the timer on my watch is going off. It probably means something. I like what Rob has revealed. He is an Untuckit customer. Okay. So Steve says, with the Vanguard Dynamic Spending, if my portfolio gives dividends, do I get to spend them as well? Yeah. So, for those of you who haven't seen it, I did a video on the Vanguard Dynamic Spending strategy. So you can check that out. Yeah, they don't, I'm telling you, all of these, I'm sure there are exceptions, but all of these different withdrawal strategies, Guyton-Klinger, Bill Bengen and his research, Kitsis and his research, Wade Fowl, Vanguard, they're looking at total return. So that includes dividends. It's all part of the same bucket. I really wouldn't think of them differently. Now, as a practical matter, particularly from a taxable account, you may spend those first because they're going to get taxed anyway. Fine. But yeah, I mean, dividends are part of all of their analysis. Now, let me look up their paper. I showed you guys a little bit of this paper in the video, and I gave you a link to it. Here it is. There was another one too, but what I wanted to see here. Yeah, they don't talk about total return specifically. Yeah, and they don't talk about dividends. So yeah, it would be, they use, Vanguard uses, actually, here it is. This is what Vanguard uses for their modeling. The Vanguard Capital Markets Model. I've not done a deep dive into the VCMM, as they call it, but it's the way they run their simulations. And I don't know what assumptions they're putting into that, but it's going to be on a total return basis. They're not going to, so, and dividends are certainly part of total return. Mark says the 14th Amendment forbids default. I've never heard of that. You could be right. I don't know. I could ask ChatGPT. Does the 14th Amendment forbid the U.S. from defaulting on debt? I get that. This is the headline I get. Debt limit options narrowing. 14th Amendment chatter returns. So I guess it's chatter. I don't know. Okay, so Jeremy says, you have had living off your money for a while now. Yes, is it back here? It's somewhere. Oh, it's here. Oh, here it is. Thoughts on portfolios with high harvesting ratio requiring 8 to 12 funds. I know you prefer fewer, simpler. So maybe I need to do a whole thing on harvesting ratio. It's a concept that obviously is talked about in this book, which I would have to refresh my memory on the specifics of it. And I even took some pretty, you know, decent notes. Can you read that? It's blurry. Anyway. Here's my concern. I don't know if I say with the book, but we can use historical data to construct. So when you think about a withdrawal strategy, actually I mentioned it last week, there's like really four components, right? Your initial withdrawal, how you calculate it, how you calculate subsequent withdrawals, which is often different, right? Your asset allocation, and then your actual withdrawal strategy, which funds you're going to take from, and do you rebalance or not? And so this book walks through kind of, it sort of groups the first two, initial withdrawal and subsequent withdrawals together as one, but it walks through all the different strategies, or a lot of the different strategies that have been proposed by various folks for each of those three. He calls them different things, but harvesting is sort of a key concept. What you can do, of course, is just use historical data, and you know, if you've got the patience and you want to churn through enough numbers, you can conclude here's the best approach. And but the problem is, or the reality is, we don't know that that will be the best approach going forward, right? Of course, we could say that about any withdrawal strategy, but my point in bringing all that up is the more specific and detailed it gets. You've got to have these, as you said, 9 or 10 or 12 asset classes or funds, and you've got to take it out in precisely this manner. I'm thinking, I don't know. The odds of that, you know, it may have done well over the last 50 years or 80 years or whatever, but something has to have done the best, right? I mean, there's going to be one that stands out amongst all of these factors. I don't see any reason to believe that it's going to repeat. And I just don't see any reason to complicate my life. But I will reread the harvesting ratio. And I'll do a video on it. I mean, it's interesting. That's what I remember about it. Thanks, Indie Dave. Enjoying your podcasts and interesting newsletter topics. I still enjoy that newsletter. You notice, by the way, I put a second postscript at the bottom that has a link to the archives, at least the archives since I started using my current email provider that I'm using. So you can go back and get all the old ones, or a lot of them. All right. Dave says he likes T-bills. He also uses VioBank Money Market. I think that's in my database. Money Market. Man, I've got more logos not working. Here's Vio. Yeah, it's pretty good. 417. Near the top, at least that's what we have it at. Let's see if we've got the interest rate correct. Yep, well, that's good. I got to work on those logos. So, what do you believe would be the effect of the U.S. government defaulting on its debt and future interest rates the U.S. would get afterwards? Well, part of it depends on the specific circumstances, I would think. You know, if it's like, you know, a day or two and Congress comes to their senses, I still don't think it'll get to that. But yeah, I mean, if invest, well, how would it affect you? Right. If we came to believe that we weren't going to get repaid or we weren't going to get repaid timely, we would demand higher rates for that risk. And the fact that it's, you know, the fact that the U.S. government could afford, so to speak, to pay us, but they're not because of Congress can't get their act together, you know, is relevant, but, you know, it's still the case that, you know, we're owed money and the debtor isn't paying us. So, yeah, I think interest rates would absolutely go up and the stock market would probably have some kind of seizure. But the reality is if that happened, the consequences would be far more severe than that because the treasury market is kind of underpins finance across the globe. And so I won't even pretend to know all the bad things that would happen if the U.S. defaulted on their debt, but it would be ugly. You know, how long it lasted obviously would matter. You know, the other thing that helps us is the fact that we're basically the reserve currency of the world. And we're the reserve currency today in part because there's no one to challenge us at the moment. But if we start defaulting on our debt, that could change quicker too. I'm not suggesting it would change overnight because I don't know what the options would be. But it would call a lot of things into question that right now are helping us deal with $31 trillion in debt. So here's a good question from Rob. And I probably could have answered this better a few years ago. When I focus on this more, do debit cards really have the same protections as credit cards? Well, first of all, a debit card is going to come from your bank, right? Your bank account. So the problem with a debit card is, if in my view, and why I don't use them, is because if someone were to be able to get access to my debit card and use it, the money comes out of my bank account, and I have to fight to get my money back. With a credit card, I haven't paid the bill yet. I can fight it without having lost any money. Of course, credit cards, I think federal law limits your loss for fraud. You have to follow the rules and report it and whatnot. I think the $50, but most credit card issuers cover it all, at least that I'm aware of. With debit cards, let's see. Consumers who use debit cards are protected by the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. Yeah, it's still $50. I don't know if there's any differences, though, in the way it works than with credit cards. It also depends on how quickly you report it. It's $50 if you report, if it's been lost or stolen, if you report that in 48 hours. Credit cards could be the same. I'm not sure. But I prefer credit over debit because I don't want people to end up with access to my bank account. At least that's how I think about it. So Travis makes a very good point. He says, gold as a standalone asset has poor returns. That's true. However, if you plug it into a diversified portfolio, it increases returns and drawdowns looking at portfolio charts. Thoughts? I agree with that. And obviously it depends what year you look at, but let's clear everything. We're going to do a three fund. Here we go. And then this will make gold, okay? So what we're going to do here is copy from one. We're going to take our gold from something. We'll do 45 US, 25 global. That gives us 10% for gold. So we're going from 87. So let's think about that for just a second here. I'll take the comment off. So that's after the big rise in gold in the late 70s, early 80s, right? My memory serves, which it may not. So portfolio one, let's give these names. And I don't want to log in. And this is, I'll just call it gold. Run this again. Why is it saying that? Please stop saying that. So that's interesting. Gold actually did not outperform in this time period, although they were pretty close here. 2009 actually underperformed here, had a lower standard deviation, so it wasn't as volatile. And they were pretty close, but actually underperformed there. But I have seen other portfolios where it's done better. And I wonder, like, what if we went 30 and 5? Does that make a difference? Not really. Interesting. But yeah, there are periods of time where adding gold does. And it's a big part, like Ray Dalio's, you know, has been a fan of it at different times, you know, sort of all-weather portfolio, risk parity kind of portfolios might use that sort of thing. I still don't own any gold. Who knows? Maybe I'll buy some at some point, but I don't have any plans to. All right. Well, to Steve says, I'm thinking about adding tips to my bond portfolio. Does this make sense in a time of almost certain falling inflation? Well, the idea of tips, if you buy individual tips and hold them to maturity or a bond fund and hold it long enough, is you're going to get whatever the real return is at the time you buy it, plus inflation. So like right now, I think tips are yielding what? 1.6, 1.7. Let's see. Let's go to, this is the Fed, St. Louis Fed data. This is a 10-year. It's yielding, 1.25. Wow. Because it was up around 1.80 at one point. I thought 1.73. But so the point is, it doesn't really matter what inflation does. Let's just assume you buy a tip bond, a bond, and you hold it to maturity. You're going to get 1.25 plus inflation. So inflation could go down. Doesn't matter. I mean, it matters, but you know, you're still going to get that 1.25. Now, part of the thinking on having tips in your portfolio is, I get it. Well, my approach is to say, I don't actually know that falling inflation is almost certain. I think of it as, I don't have any idea what inflation is going to do. And even if I do think it's going to fall, and I'm right about that over the next year, that doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is the next 20 or 30 years, and I really have no idea. And so I have both. I have tips and I have nominal bonds, kind of covering both bases. That's my approach anyway. This is a good point that I neglected to mention. You know, T-bills are state and local income tax free. That may or may not be important to you. Why would you buy a CD that pays less for 18 months? I think T-bills are safer. I don't know that I would say T-bills are safer. And you could, but yeah, I think T-bills are great right now. So I got no argument there. All right. Well, this doesn't make sense to me, Andre. I was told by someone at Treasury that Treasury debt takes priority over FDIC obligations because FDIC obligations aren't paid out by the Treasury, or not in the sense they're not part of, you know, the debt ceiling, and you know, the FDIC insurance fund comes from member banks. But maybe there's more to it than that. Kelly mentioned a good video by Diamond Nest Egg, which, if I recall correctly, is a great channel. It does a lot on I bonds and tips. And let me look it up. Diamond Nest Egg. Is that what she's called? Yes. Here she is. It said the video came out today. Okay, we hit the debt ceiling. Now what? U.S. default in your bonds. She does really good. I like her videos a lot. I haven't watched those, but. Also, tag me in the question if you want me to. I'm kind of scrolling through, but if you tag me, I can see it. This one didn't tag me, but I noticed the peekaboo. Can you talk about your time at the PCAOB? What was it like? I loved my time at the PCAOB. So it's a public company accounting oversight board. I even played on the softball team. Actually, I never played once. I was on the team, got my t-shirt, which is obviously I got it framed, and then I hurt my back and I couldn't play. Which is probably better for the team anyway. And then I've got something else here somewhere. I've got my signature board when I left anyway. So, I mean, the PCOB was a great place to work. Work environment, work-life balance, all that kind of stuff was terrific, which was a big deal for me as a lawyer. You know, like when I was at the law firm, work-life balance could get out of hand. But at the PCOB, it didn't. Benefits were great. You started, I don't know what it is today. When you started, you started with 1 week of vacation already in the bank, and then you got 6 weeks a year. So for your first year, you actually get 7. And then you get a couple of floaters, and then there were 10 holidays. It's kind of ridiculous. And they matched dollar for dollar, the 401k. Yeah, it was pretty good. I don't even know why I left now that I'm thinking about it. But I love the work. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about auditing, financial statements. I've probably forgotten it all by now. And then they went and they changed the numbers for all of the auditing standards, so now I don't even know. I was talking the other day about audit documentation and I forget who I was talking with now, but yeah, Rule 3. Well, it's not Rule 3 anymore. I think it was Rule 3. Audit documentation rule. What was the rule? Was it Rule 3? Yeah, auditing standard number 3, but it's not anymore. Now it's auditing standard. Is it AU 339? So I couldn't even, I'd have to relearn all of the numbers before I could actually take a testimony or understand the rules. Anyway, I don't know what else you want to know, Dave. It was good. I liked it. So the video, they're saying, you guys are saying it's fuzzy. I don't know. Is it not 1080? I don't know. I'll have to look at it next week. Of course, some people are saying it's fine. Kit, hello. Welcome to the show. Number of people, though, say it's fuzzy. Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm out of focus. Peng says, I saw you at the Boglehead Conference. Are you a Boglehead? Well, I am a Boglehead in the sense that I think index fund investing, low-cost index fund investing is the best way. I haven't been actively involved in the Boglehead group for the most part. I'm not active on the forum, not for any particular reason. I'm just not. But I spoke at the Boglehead Conference and had a lot of fun there. I know a lot of people. I've known Rick Ferry forever, Mike Piper. And I'll probably, well, this year it's in DC, so I'll definitely be there. So back to the poll. How likely is U.S. to default on the debt? 4% of you think it's very likely, 8% likely. But 55% say not very likely and 33% say not a chance. I would probably say not very likely would have been my vote. I'm not allowed to vote in my own polls, which just seems wrong. Um, So Scott says, with all the security breaches in the news, how concerned are you about using web apps that track your financial accounts? Not too concerned, but I do a number of things. I mean, I have two-factor authentication on everything, not just financial accounts, but email as well. I'm no longer using LastPass, at least not for my key accounts. I've switched to a different password manager. I use really complicated passwords. By the way, for passwords that you need to remember, like the password to your password manager, one of the things I found useful is I'll create a password that tells a story that I'll easily remember. So let's say you were at a game in San Francisco and you caught a Barry Bonds home run ball. Obviously, this would have been a few years ago. You could imagine a password like Barry Bonds Homer. But of course, you would add things to it. Maybe the date you were there. You would take some letters and substitute symbols. You would use some capital. So there would be some things that you would need to remember. But within that context, you could create a 15 character or longer password with several symbols, numbers, uppercase, lowercase, and get a pretty decent complicated password. Now, but using a password manager like the ones I use, the actual passwords like my financial accounts get really, they're nothing that I could ever remember. But I will say that I did spend some time disconnecting any accounts with apps that I no longer use. I did do that. So Kit says, W-2 employee generating some side income from freelance work. I'm thinking of starting an LLC. Am I eligible for SEP IRA via my LLC if my employer provides 401k plan? So first of all, I'm not a tax person. So I'll give you my understanding, but you need to talk to a tax person. Yes. You can. I can tell you I had a SEP IRA. I don't know that you have to be an LLC, actually. But I'm not positive. I was an LLC at the time, but I don't think that's a requirement. But your tax person can tell you for sure. But I contributed to a SEP while I also contributed to a 401k plan associated with a different company, right? Now, calculating how much you can contribute to the SEP IRA, you definitely want to get your tax accountant to help you with that. And as the sole owner, presumably of the LLC, it's going to be different because SEP IRAs you could also use it to contribute, with other folks in your company, but if you're a freelancer, I'm guessing it's just you. But yeah, you should be able to, but you will be limited to a percentage of your income. And I don't know if it's which income number it is from your business, but just keep that in mind. It may not be as much as you think, but it may be, it depends how much you're making. That seemed like a stumbling answer. I'm doing two things, Kelly. I do have some T-bills. They were all short. I mean, I haven't bought any in a month or so. I have several that mature in February. But part of that was tied to when I'm going to need the money. And then I do have the bond. I have a short bond blocks ETF. I think it's 6 months. I'll show it to you here. It's not much money, but I'm kind of dumping money into that right now so I can just pull it. Well, you can always sell T-bills anytime, but it's this one. It's XHLF. Again, this is not a recommendation. This is what I'm putting a small amount of money in, and I'm going to be putting more in it tomorrow, actually. So its yield to maturity at the moment is 4.5. It's a target 6-month duration. And it's cheap. It's 3 basis points. Steve, maybe I'm not smart enough, but I don't understand that question. Turning your company into an ESOP. To me, ESOP is employee stock option plan, but I'm guessing you mean something else, or I'm just not following. All right. So Rob says, is there a tool for analyzing investments that allows input of percentages of the cap? I don't know what the cap growth matrix is. You know, like maybe the Morningstar box? I guess that maybe that's what you mean. Capital, I don't know. Instead of inputting individual ETFs and stocks, my financial advisor has me in over 30 equities. What? Well, Personal Capital will give you, break out the asset allocation. It goes beyond just the ETFs. I mean, it looks into the ETFs and figures out the asset allocation. So that might be an answer for you. I think Stock Rover does something similar. I haven't shown you guys Stock Rover in a while. Let me log in if I can. My Premium Plus trial expired. That's okay. Oh, it locks me out of some information. I may have to re-up. Let's see here. So like, this was a David Swensen portfolio that I built. I mean, this is all just with, you know, made up data. I don't even remember what balance I put in here. But you can, let's see here. See, normally I have access to all of this, which I don't at the moment. So, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm pretty sure this gives you asset allocation. I know it does. But I don't know if you need the premium edition to do that. Don't know. I'll look into that. But Personal Capital does that, I think. I think it's doing what you're asking. Morningstar would too, by the way. I mean, you could create a portfolio there. You have to pay for that. So, yes, a portfolio visualizer will break it out. It's not that part of portfolio visualizer, I don't think, is the easiest to use or to read. It's not as pretty as, say, a Personal Capital, but it will do it. Yeah, I hear you, Vinyl. Vinyl says Apple does design their own chips and so forth, but they're not in the business of selling chips. I mean, I know they sell them as part of their phones and computers and whatnot. It's just like, I wouldn't consider Ford a technology company, but it sells chips, I guess, if you look at it that way. So does Deere & Company. I don't know. So Chris says, what are your thoughts about investing in Tesla stock? I just wouldn't do it right now. I don't know if I ever would. Valuations are still high in my view. And I think as much as I enjoy sort of watching Elon and his antics, I'm not sure I want to put my money on, you know, into that. And I think once, to me, and I'm not an EV market expert by any stretch, but to me there are two things that help that kind of put Tesla ahead of other car companies or have given them advantage. One is their range. Of course, other cars are catching up, but their range and their autopilot features. But I think once the other car companies catch up, and they're catching up now, but once they catch up, I think people are going to look at Tesla and it's like, man, that's an ugly car. I don't know. It's just my take on it. I could be totally wrong. By the way, no offense intended for folks that own Teslas. I almost bought one and I still might. The only reason I didn't was they couldn't deliver it. And I kept waiting and waiting. Richard, hello from Iowa. Thanks for joining the show. All right. DB says, congrats to the Bengals, Chiefs, Eagles, and 49ers. Hope I don't trigger the non-NFL fans. Oh, come on. I mean, I'm rooting for the Bengals. I've never really been a Bengals fan, even though I grew up in Ohio. Some of the games, though, weren't – I didn't think the games were – I don't know. Certainly the 49ers-Cowboys game was kind of a drag. Watching Patrick Mahomes limp around the field, that was something. Although I was thinking, if I'm Henny, the backup quarterback, who did great for one drive, I'm thinking, you're telling me I'm not better than a guy who has to limp? But it is Patrick Mahomes, so there's that. You know, it's interesting. If you guys watched the which game was it? I don't remember now. But Tony Romo was in the booth, which I forget which game that was. But was that – maybe it was the Bengals game. He was talking about Mahomes, and he was saying, you know, he was probably he better able to play that night than he might be a week from now. It could actually get worse. You know, because it was all taped up, he was still warm, and then you know the ankle. He said, "Oh, he thinks he'll play next week because just so much is on riding on the game, but he could be still in pretty rough shape." Okay. That's a good question. Clint says, "Is there ever a good reason to buy a bond fund that is returning less than a money market fund?" Well, so. Here's the deal. Let's look at these. So we'll look at BND first. So the SEC yield, which would be the you know what it paid out last month and then annualized, it's 4%, right? I'll take the comment down now. Now, I don't know. SPACs may not be in here. No, but I can pull it up. A lot of these sort of money market funds, you won't find in Morningstar. So its current yield is 7-day yield is 3.85. It's actually lower right now. But there are times, like if you go back to BND, here we go. Ah, come on, Vanguard or Morningstar. Go back to BND. You could look at this and say, well, why would I invest in this? Treasury bills are paying more than that, right? And there could be other money market funds that are. But the thing to keep in mind, one way to look at it is to say, okay, would I rather invest in a 5-year CD that's paying 3% or a 1-year CD that's paying 4%? And again, one way would be to say, well, 4% is better than 3%, so why in the world would I invest in a 5-year CD? Well, you might because a year from now, let's imagine the 1 year is now paying 2% and the 5-year is still paying 3%. Now, of course, you got your you got your 4% on the 1 year for that year, but now what are you going to do? I guess you could say, well, then I'll invest in the 5-year because it's paying 3%. Well, what if it's now paying 3.25%? I mean, 2.25%. So it's still higher than the 1 year now, but it's much lower than it was a year ago. If you followed all those numbers, you'd say, well, yeah, I wish I would if I'd invested a year ago in the 5-year 3% CD, I would get that 3% for the full 5 years. And if I stick with shorter term, I might feel good about it now. But if rates fall, I might not feel so good about it a year from now. To which you might say, well, Rob, but you're assuming rates will go down. Yes, in that hypothetical, I am. To which you might say, well, what if they stay the same or what if they go up? That could happen. Which is why I tend to, except for money I'm going to need or for an emergency fund, I tend to stick with intermediate term bonds. That's just kind of what I do. And there are going to be times when they don't pay as much as short term, when the yield curve inverts and all that. So that happens from time to time. I hope that makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense to me. Let's see. So Nick wants to know where I'd park emergency savings, high yield savings at online bank versus a money market fund in a brokerage account. I guess part of it depends on what you're going to do with it. Meaning, is just one or the other more convenient? For the most part, I think both options are good. Keep in mind, a money market fund at a brokerage is not FDIC insured. It's still fairly very secure, short-term paper. In fact, let's go back to the Fidelity fund. The weighted average maturity of this fund, can you guys read that? It's 4 days. So it's very, very, very short-term paper. I still like T-bills. And I buy them, through a broker. I don't go to Treasury Direct. But I think online banks, you get a good rate. That's a perfectly reasonable approach. I would say T-bills right now are probably paying more than online banks for the most part. But I think they're both good options. And I actually have both right now. I have more in T-bills than online bank accounts, but all right. Vinyl says if you buy a value stock at a low price, it's very likely to go up sooner or later. That I suppose that's true if it's a good company, but it could be much later. So you just got to be prepared for that. Oh, this is good. Look at this. Richard says, high dividends are the poisoned pawns of investing. He worked in chess there. There's actually a variation of the Nydorf that's called the poisoned pawn variation. I'm sure you guys want me to show you that right now on the screen, don't you? Probably not. I need to put up another poll. I just don't know what to put up there right now. All right. So Ethan says, I heard once that pattern recognition is the key to winning at chess. Obviously, you have to consider the consequences and think moves ahead, but the savants see patterns. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And the patterns help you figure out what's important too. Because and that's true, I guess, there's a lot of overlap with investing and other things. There's a lot of information going on a chessboard, just like there's a lot of information. You go to Morningstar and you look up a fund like this, and it just throws a ton of information at you. But you got to know what it means and what's more important. What's the most important thing? You can, and this just is the tip of the iceberg, right? We can go into the risk analysis and see tons of information. Well, what matters and what doesn't? And on a chessboard, that's important. What really matters right now? And patterns help you figure that out. And patterns help you analyze. If you think about, they talk about speed reading and how I'm not a speed reader, but people read in chunks versus word by word. And that's how I think about patterns. Grandmasters in many, many situations are taking in the board and seeing groups of pieces at one time and understanding that pattern. Whereas if I'm not familiar with that pattern or don't notice it, I might be looking at the chessboard and doing, okay, if I move my knight there, they'll move their bishop there. And let me try to make sure I visualize that. Okay, well, then I'm going to move my pawn. And you're thinking, just like reading word by word, you're thinking move by move. And every chess player has to do that at times. But the better you are, the more patterns you can recognize, you can start thinking in groups or chunks of moves. That makes sense. So Clarice says, does any REIT ETF stand out to you these days? Not really. My REIT investing has always been very boring. I've always just used the Vanguard REIT Index. Is it VNQ? I think that's the ETF version. Yeah. this is what I've always invested in when I've had a REIT. I can't tell you this is the best. I've just never done a deep dive to think about, is there some other better REIT out there? There very well could be. You know, this is your basic index fund, low cost, and it's done pretty well. I don't know of a better one. So which password managers to look at? So there were a couple that I looked at. I'm not going to tell you which one I actually used or am using. Although, now that I think about it, probably wouldn't be that hard to figure out. I'm seeing if I can, there was a list that I came across. I don't know if I can find it. I think 1Password is excellent. I think actually, if you have Apple computers, their keychain password is good. It has limitations. There was a list that I saw. I don't think I'm going to be able to find it quickly. Let me try one other thing. Bitwarden, I've heard good things about. Never used it. Yeah, I can't find that list. I'm sorry. The thing, I'll tell you the thing that upset me about LastPass was the way they dealt with the problem. And I just didn't feel like they were forthcoming in their disclosures at all. And so I lost faith in management of the company. So I'm still in the process of moving some passwords out of there, but I've moved all the important ones out. Well, here's a 1Password recommendation. So there you go. I will say I'm using 1Password. I don't know why I didn't want to tell you to begin with. I'm using 1Password. I like it. All right. Curly wants to know, does it make more sense to keep money in a brokerage account than a traditional IRA? Long-term cap gains tax is less than income tax rate. Well, so I assume this is for retirement and this is long-term. And there's been a lot of analysis on this question, but I think at the end of the day, for me, an IRA still makes more sense. Assuming, I mean, you can have too much. I'm going to assume we're not talking about a Roth for the moment. You can have too much traditional, right? That will end up causing you headaches when you get to the RMD age. So I don't think this is a one kind of answer, you know, fits for everybody. There could be circumstances where one would make more sense than the other. But there's still the advantage of holding off on the taxes for potentially decades. And also, if you, depending on your circumstance, if you can then possibly convert some of the traditional to Roth during years when your income is low, say you've retired, but you're not yet taking Social Security and you've not yet hit the RMD age. Of course, you've always got to consider Medicare premiums and IRMA, but where you can do some Roth conversions at really low rates. So every circumstance is different, but no, I still like retirement accounts, again, up to a point. I don't know where this comes from. I don't know. Maybe I should auction off my shirts. I don't know. Maybe this is an asset. I should put it on our net worth statement. So Vina wants to know if I would include expensive possessions in your net worth if they are readily sellable. I suppose I might, maybe if my plan was to sell them. Uh, But I don't. I'm not sure what I have that I would even consider. I just like to keep it simple. These are always tough questions. This is from Thomas. A family member has a pension plan with three options. $950,000 lump sum, $5,300 per month for life, or $4,500 per month for life with a $250,000 lump sum. So the first thing I would do if I were in that situation, I would talk to an hourly-based financial planner that I trusted to run some numbers. Conceptually, there are a few things I would think about. So keep in mind with a certain amount per month for life, you know, of course, once you die, the money stops. There's nothing that family members can inherit. Now, I suppose the one option gives you $250,000 lump sum, right? So you have that. But it's the same thing with an annuity. Now, with annuities, you can't have like, you know, a certain time period where you're guaranteed the money. But short of that, you die, the money stops and there's nothing for your family, your children or whatever to inherit. So that's a factor. The other thing I would look at is who's paying the pension and how secure are they? Another factor I would look at is tax. I don't know the taxes on any of this. So tax consequences would weigh in on it. The other thing I would think about is if I took the 950 and bought annuities, and I say plural because I probably wouldn't buy just one from one insurance company. I'd probably spread it out. I don't know over how many, two or three maybe. But what kind of monthly payment would I get? You know, part of that too would be, are the pension payments indexed for inflation? So these would all be questions that I would be thinking about and asking. You know, obviously, how old am I? What's my life expectancy? You know, am I married? Do I have a significant other? Can I set it up so that I get a slightly less amount each month, but then my significant other continues to get the benefit? Should I die first? These would all be questions that I would be asking. I'm sure there might be others, but those are the ones that come to mind. All right. So Brad says, the camera and lighting are on point for your videos. What camera do you use? So I have a Sony. What is it? Alpha 6400, Sony A6400, mirrorless system camera. I don't know. I'm looking. I think this is the one I've got, but I do have a different lens. Yeah. So here's the camera. There it is. I don't think I paid that much for it. Of course, I bought it a couple of years ago. So maybe, oh, look at that. I don't have, the lens I have is nothing all that special. Let me see if I can find it real quick. Where are my lists? No. That's not it, is it? Oh, here it is. Oh, it's just a Sigma 16 millimeter. Yeah, that's it. Right here, this lens, nothing fancy. That's on sale. Look at that. And the lighting that I'm using are just key lights. They were like maybe a couple hundred bucks from Elgato. Yeah, they look like this. Obviously you can't see them, but that's what they look like. They just attach to my desk. I've got one on each side and I can control it from my computer. So like I can go completely dark. That's probably, that may be an improvement. Although I'm looking at myself and I look kind of scary. I can also change the color. Let's see if we can, I'm looking over at the screen so I can see what it does. Yeah, that's not any good, but I can change the color. It goes from blues to like oranges and I can control the brightness. I can turn one light off. Anyway, there you go. This is funny. Corey says, does Tom Selleck have a YouTube channel? He's the reverse mortgage expert from what I hear. Yeah, I think he does some commercials, doesn't he? I always like the, you know, the folks like that. And I'm a Tom Selleck fan. I watch Blue Bloods. I think it's a great show. And I watched Magnum PI, you know, when it was out originally. But these actors, like his age, that are selling reverse mortgages and gold and, well, whatever. Kelly says, I bought my husband an Untuckit based on your recommendation. He wears it way too much. I need to get another one. I have a whole closet full. I probably have eight. And I do. I cycle through them so that you guys don't see the same shirt. It's like if I do a video tomorrow, so this one will go to the end, the back of the closet. In fact, they're all down here in the basement. I don't even keep them in my closet upstairs because I wear them here. If I need one to go out with, which isn't all that often, I'll come down here and get one. But yeah, it just goes to the end, pull the next one out. All right. It's 8:25. VJ. Hello, Rob from Snowy, Michigan. Well, hello. By the way, what is going on with your coach? A level one violation? I don't know. I wonder if we have to put an asterisk next to their two wins over Ohio State the last 2 years. Sounds pretty serious. They say he lied to the NCAA. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. It's just the allegation. All right. I think he's going back. Why does there have to be a controversy every stinking year about whether he's going to stay or go? Whatever. So if you're going to have bonds in a taxable account, would you recommend municipal bonds? So municipal bonds, you don't pay federal income tax. You may not pay state income tax if they're issued out of your state, but not necessarily. It depends on your tax bracket for starters. Certainly if, you know, if I lived in California and I was, you know, made a lot of money and what's their top tax rate? Like 400%. Okay. Maybe it's not that high. 13%. You add in almost 40% at the federal level. Of course, you know, I would probably be in a California municipal bond fund if I wanted to be in my taxable account. But beyond that, you know, it depends how much money we're talking about, what your tax bracket is, because that's going to determine whether it makes sense to be in a municipal bond fund. I certainly would consider them, and I've owned municipal bond funds in the past, but I wouldn't conclude that that's the only reasonable choice. Just depends on the circumstances. You know, treasuries do have no state income tax. Again, obviously, you're paying more at the federal level, and some of you don't pay state income tax. You live in Tennessee or Florida or Texas or I'm sure other places. Alaska, does Alaska have state income tax? I don't think they do. They don't need to, right? Does Alaska have state income tax? I don't think so. They have corporate tax. They don't have a state sales tax. There's no statewide sales tax levy. There's no personal state income tax. Yeah, anyway. Here we go. So Ram says, Wells Fargo again fined $2 billion this week for crimes. In 6 years, $20 billion. Yes, terrible. I do think about it. I mean, the issue is primarily for events that occurred maybe entirely before I bought Wells Fargo stock. Although they had a recent issue, or recent, I don't know how recent it was, with their mortgage business. I don't know if the events that led to that were before or after I bought their stock. I just don't remember. This one, I can't type. This is the CFPB. This was just, that's December, which we knew about. I just don't know when this occurred. Here's what I'm looking at, by the way, just so you can follow along. I was just seeing if I could quickly see when these events occurred. As early as 2015, which would have been before I invested. but I don't know if I'm just reading through it quickly. Anyway, so, but yeah, it does bother me. But part of my investing decision was they got a mess on their hands. They've got totally new management. They're trying to clean it up. It's going to be ugly. It's going to take time. They're going to pay a lot of fines, most of which was already baked into the price. So I got a very low valuation. And it's actually done pretty well for me. And if, you know, if they can turn things around, if they can get the limits on this, the size of their bank lifted eventually, I think it could be a decent investment. But yeah, it's not lost on me. Now, if current ownership started doing the same as current ownership, current management started doing the shenanigans, it's a very technical legal term, I would sell it. Yeah, I would definitely sell it. So Michael asked me about basically the cost or gain in selling the secondary market. So I've never purchased T-bills on the secondary market, nor have I ever sold before they've matured. Of course, they're all short term. I don't know that there's a lot of gain. I mean, this is such a highly liquid market. You know, when you're buying or selling, there's going to be some costs involved, but they're going to be minimal. And, someone who's done this a lot could speak to it certainly more intelligently than I could, but I don't think, at least for your typical retail investor, you're not going to get like a bargain that I'm aware of. You know, they're going to be selling at a price based on when they mature and current interest rates. Obviously if interest rates have come down, the value will go up, but they're short-term bonds. The value is not going to go up a lot. And if rates have gone up, the value will go down, again, depending on how much is left until maturity, which could be in the secondary market you're buying, it could be just weeks, right? Or even days, I suppose. But so I just generally find this, I buy it when they issue them, is what I've just done. But I don't think I've bought any on the secondary market. Maybe I have. I don't think so, though. I mean, like at a Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity, it's pretty easy to do. You know, public, which is not a, this is public. I've not really done a deep dive into public myself, but this is a broker. And they came up with some new strategy, not strategy, but some new way to buy treasuries. Now this says coming soon. So maybe they just have announced it. But I actually had an email exchange with someone from there, I think in their marketing department, but I was trying to understand what the big deal was. Like, does it make it easier? I don't know. It's not that hard to buy treasuries at any broker, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe someone has used public can comment in the chat, but I don't know. I'm going to check that out, but I can't imagine like using it. Just public could be great. It's just, it's hard for me to imagine switching to a new broker just to buy treasuries, because it's not that difficult as it is now. It's 8:32. I'm over time. I've gone over by 2 minutes. I gotta bring this plane in for landing. So Clifford says, I would buy a t-shirt with Rob's headshot, AKA Burgerhead. That's funny. So every now and again, I get either, I guess, from folks that watch the show or from people in the business wanting to know if I want to sell merch. Do I want merch? I don't know. I just don't feel like a merch kind of person. Should I have merch? Here we go. This will be the last poll of the night. Start a poll. Should I sell merch? Yes. For the love of God, no. There you go. By the way, feel free to vote however you want, of course. 100% is yes, but that's only on one vote. So first vote was a yes. I should sell merch. Then the follow-up question would be, what am I selling? Coffee mugs, maybe. T-shirts? I don't know. I can tell you this. I don't care how you guys vote. I'm not selling a shirt with my picture on it. That is never going to happen. Jeff says, Burgermeister, Meister Burger. You know, I've heard that before. Growing up with the name Burger, it wasn't always a fun time. I'm just going to say that. So we've still got, so 63%, 64% is saying, for the love of God, no. I'll tell you one thought I did have. It has nothing to do with merch, by the way. As you know, I'm constantly working on books. And I probably shouldn't mention it because it could be 17 years before I actually publish one. I'm working on a novel. I'm working on two, you know, investing books. One of the things that I find hard about writing a book, you know, I kind of romanticize this idea of, you know, toiling away, doing all this research, you know, writing just and taking a year just to make this perfect book. But when you actually, when it's 2 p.m. and you can either do that or play some speed chess, I'm telling you, speed chess wins. So then one thought I had was, why not do something like Substack, which you'd have some free content on there and you'd have some paid content. I think that, you know, you can set up whatever. It's like a few bucks a month or whatever. I don't subscribe to any Substacks at the moment, but where I put out there like chapters at a time. So as I wrote a chapter of the book, I put it out, even if the book doesn't get published for 2 years, but you could sort of read the book as I'm writing it. And you could comment on it. Like there's places for comments, Rob, you got this wrong, or you could ask a question, or what do you think about adding this or that or whatever. It's just a thought that came to me the other day. I was reading an article where someone effectively did that. Kind of like, you know, I read when Stephen King came out with The Green Mile, which is, I think, one of his best books. It was serialized to begin with. You know, I think it was in 6 parts, maybe. And I read it like, so he would, this was all, of course, you know, in hard paperback. This wasn't online. But I remember I, you know, get to the store and buy, you know, each section was like this big or whatever. And it, of course, it was so good. And then you'd finish it like you can't wait for the next one to come out. It was a lot of fun. Of course, many, many eons ago, that's how a lot of books were published. All right. I think the merch is a no, at least based on, should I be the Elon Musk? I will do whatever you guys say. I don't think so. But I think you're safe on the merch for now. Okay, I'm going to do one more poll, even though it's 8:36. Should I release my books as I write them? I mentioned Substack, but that doesn't have to be Substack. That's probably what I would use. But should I release my books as I write them? Yes, no. That's my last question, and then I'll let you guys go. Substack, there would be a fee. I mean, like, I don't know what the typical subscription is. Of course, if I did that, I'd probably have other content on there besides just the books. I don't know. I haven't thought that far ahead. Now, this is interesting. Douglas says that he exported his LastPass vault, imported it into 1Password, cleaned up LastPass, and then changed all the passwords. Well, that's really good. Yeah, I knew you could export. I didn't know. I'll have to look at that, because that would be easier. See, the problem with LastPass, for those of you that used it, was that you can't just change your LastPass password. Because in theory, if they can get into the vault that they stole, they'll have all of your existing passwords. Now, if you have a really difficult password, the odds of them breaking into your LastPass vault are probably slim. At least that's what LastPass says. But the point is, you got to go in and change all of the passwords, you know, that you saved in LastPass. But that's a good tip. All right. So Random. He dumped Wells Fargo and Bank of America during all their scandals. I didn't know Bank of America had scandals like Wells Fargo did. I don't think. I own them both. They've been good investments, but the scandals are problematic, but we'll see what they do in the future. All right, what do we got here? So 71% said yes. 29% said no. I think what I'll probably do is continue working on the books, get ahead to a point, and then make the decision what I'm going to do. The reason that I think releasing them as I go, forget where or how I do it, but if I release them as I go, I think I'll be more motivated to do it. Because, you know, you just write one chapter, or I could even, depending on the book, I could even, it doesn't have to be a whole chapter, right? I could even divide a chapter into two or three posts. But I think I would be more inclined to, you know, get this relatively small project done and release it and then get feedback, and rather than working on something that I'm, while I'm sitting there working on it and thinking it's not going to see the light of day for 18 months or something, if that makes any sense. It's one of the reasons I haven't gone, I won't probably go with a traditional publisher on any of these. I suppose if I released it this way, I could. I've talked to an agent, and I think I could get a contract. But once they have the book, it's at least another year before it gets published, and that just drives me crazy. So remember, next week, no live stream. I will not, no live stream next Monday. The following Monday, I should be back. Again, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. So, but remember, no live stream next week. The newsletter, of course, still continues to go out every Sunday. So you can subscribe to that below the video. Hope you guys have a great week. And I don't know why I just gave you the thumbs up. That's really kind of embarrassing, really. It's like doing this. It's not good. Anyway, have a great week. And until next time, remember, the best thing money can buy is financial freedom. The thumbs up. What was I thinking?